Greetings, listeners and friends of RAOTC. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying welcome to this broadcast for November 2018.
And hello, listeners, from me.
You know by now that this broadcast is carried on a range of frequencies each first Monday morning of the month, except for January. Our club website is www.raotc.org.au, and many people download the broadcast from there. But don't forget, there is a repeat transmission at night at 20:30 hours local time on 80 metres, and a telecast at 2,000 hours emanating from Tasmania. This telecast contains not only the RAOTC monthly broadcast, but news from around the world as well. This broadcast is put out by Tony, VK7AX, and may be viewed on the internet by putting www.bravoalphatangocharlie.tv/streams, at Sierra Tango Romeo Echo Alpha Mike Sierra /7AX. Into your search engine. Give it a try. You may be pleasantly surprised.
Just a few items of club news for you this month. The new committee will hold its first meeting for the 2018-2019 year in the middle of this month. No doubt there will be plenty to discuss, and possibly we shall have a summary of that meeting in next month's broadcast. As mentioned in last month's broadcast, the QSO party held in September was beset with poor conditions this year. At the time of writing these notes, I have received only 12 logs indicative of those conditions. Nevertheless, the VK6s again showed their enthusiasm for the event by working amongst themselves. I am pleased to announce that Clive Wallace, VK6 CSW, is again the winner for this year. I am also pleased to say that there was a little CW activity by me, with 5 contacts in all, 2 completed, 1 disappeared, and 2 did not reply to my calls. Thank you all who took part, and to those who sent in logs. The full results should by now be on our club website. I am convinced that the QSO party needs a revamp, so if you have any ideas about this, please get in touch. An email to the club email address will get to me safely. We heard recently that sometimes this broadcast is repeated by various clubs and individuals at times after the first Monday of each month. One such club is apparently the Geelong Amateur Radio Club. For interstate listeners, Geelong is a large regional city southwest of Melbourne. It has a very active amateur radio club, which you can read about in AR magazine. I also heard a few months ago that Mike, VK8MA, was interested in making the broadcast available as a podcast. However, I do not know how this idea developed. We would like to say thank you to everyone for their efforts and support of RAOTC. The extra coverage is most appreciated. New and deceased members. We are pleased to welcome into membership of RAOTC this month Steve Pettit, VK2ZVQ. Previous call signs VK2KBL and VK2KXG, who became full member number 1752 on the 6th of October 2018. Welcome to you, Steve. We hope that you will be happy in RAOTC. It is with great regret that we must advise of the passing of 3 of our members this month. John Howard, VK2AMH, RAOTC member number 1520, on the 16th of July 2018, and Bruce Wilson, VK3IG, member number 1639. No date has been given for Bruce's death. Finally, we announce that Chris Dodd, VK6DV, member number 1501, became a silent key on the 3rd of October, just 2 days after his 91st birthday. Let us pause a moment in memory of our departed colleagues. Thank you.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
I'm sure that everyone would have heard of Archimedes of Syracuse, or Syracuse if you prefer, who lived from approximately 287 to 212 BC. He was a mathematician, physicist, inventor and astronomer. He is perhaps best remembered for deriving an accurate approximation of pi. As part of our series highlighting important people who have contributed to science over the years, we turn today to Archimedes of Syracuse, or if you prefer, Syracuse, the man that gave us the Eureka moment. This article is written by Jack Condy, a freelance writer based in Annapolis, Maryland, USA. Eureka! Mathematician Archimedes is reputed to have exclaimed when, sitting in a bath, he discovered what is now called the Archimedes Principle. In ancient Greek, Eureka simply means, I have found it, but it was Archimedes, a native of the city of Syracuse, who gave us today's usage as a pronouncement of breakthrough or great discovery. As well as being good with numbers, he was also an inventor, a device he came up with to lift water from a well or a ditch became known as the Archimedes screw and is still in use in many places today. The principle that led to his famous outburst was also about the nature of fluids. It states that an object partially or fully submerged in any fluid is pushed upwards by a force equal to the weight of the fluid that the object displaces. So, for something to stay afloat, the weight of the object above the water level needs to be equal to the weight of the water the submerged part displaces. This principle is one of the main reasons that Archimedes is credited as a pioneer of physics and mathematics. His work is particularly striking because it brought the two disciplines together for one of the first times in history. Rather than reporting on the results of experiments or pointing to observations for his reasoning, techniques favoured by his predecessor Aristotle, Archimedes' works are entirely abstract, paving the way for the standardised approach to science that is essential for fields such as theoretical physics. The situation that gave rise to his personal Eureka moment, however, was rather more worldly in nature. Archimedes was ordered by the tyrant of Syracuse, Hiero, to discover whether a local crown maker was ripping him off. The tyrant suspected that the artisan who had been commissioned to create a solid gold crown had switched out some of the precious metal for less valuable gold. Sitting in a bath, cogitating, Archimedes formulated his principle. The amount of water displaced by an object is directly proportional to the object's weight. Therefore, silver being lighter than gold, a pure gold crown should displace more water than one made of the two metals combined. Eureka, indeed. It wasn't healthy to disappoint the tyrant. By using geometry and other mathematical abstractions in his work, Archimedes was able to isolate and describe the forces that govern our world. Mathematical reasoning is a necessary language for talking about force, because we can only observe them indirectly by measuring their effects. For example, we can see the apple fall from the tree, but not what's causing it to fall. Archimedes wrote many treatises, of which 11 remain. In one, On the Equilibrium of Planes, he dealt with the concept of weight. He considered it a mysterious downward inclination that affected even two-dimensional shapes. By treating it in such an abstract way, Archimedes was able to pinpoint what later would be characterized as centers of gravity. He also discovered the law of the lever, that weights are balanced when placed at distances proportional to them. For example, if weight A sits 2 centimetres from the centre of a scale, while weight B sits 1 centimetre from the centre in the opposite direction, and it is balanced, then the ratio of A to B is 2 to 1. This is a forerunner of Isaac Newton's second law of motion, that change in the momentum of an object is proportional to the force applied. The law of the lever sees A and B as forces that push things down rather than weights. Archimedes' most abstract success, and evidence suggests his proudest achievement, was discovering the relationship between spheres and cylinders. When a sphere and a cylinder have the same height and diameter, he showed, the sphere has 2/3 the volume and surface area of the cylinder. How do we know that particular mathematical eureka moment was his proudest? The Roman writer Cicero reports visiting his tomb and seeing it topped by a large cylinder and a sphere.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
Our second talk this month is on deafness, something that can affect us as we get older. For this article, we are indebted to Clive Wallace, VK6CSW, who sent it along earlier this year.
Mythology has it that during World War I, a message was passed by word of mouth along the line of trenches. We are going to advance to the right. Soldiers at the far end of the line grinned cheerfully. When asked why they looked so happy at the prospect of imminent slaughter, they replied, "We are going to a dance tonight." Deafness and misunderstanding has afflicted mankind since time immemorial. Our hearing generally deteriorates with age, although disease, industrial exposure, and mishap all play their part. Man's ingenuity has always attempted to compensate. A young child may have a dynamic hearing range well in excess of 130 decibels, that is, 10 million million times, and be able to hear frequencies in excess of 20 kilohertz. How many listeners can still hear the tick of their wristwatch? Yes, most electric watches do indeed tick, or hear the 15 kilohertz whistle of the TV line oscillator. How many of us mishear words during an on-air QSO, or, worse still, mishear the XYL? These days, audiology is a vast science, and much can be done to alleviate deafness, from simple sound amplification to cochlear implants. Today, we take a very brief look at hearing aids and aids to hearing throughout the ages, but we really only scratch the surface. Hearing loss, natural or otherwise, causes 4 main problems. 1. Loss of high-frequency response, making consonants like S for Sierra and F for Foxtrot difficult to distinguish. For example, he, seen Jack anywhere? She, eh, what? K, Cat's having a fit, I reckon. He? What? I hope Jack won't be long in there. I'm absolutely busting. 2. Loss of acuity makes softer sounds inaudible. Speak up. Do you think I'm deaf? 3. Difficulty separating wanted sounds from background noise, such as at noisy locations, parties, etc. And 4. Loss of dynamic range. Here, low sounds are inaudible, loud ones may be painful or distorted. While nothing can ever replace what nature gave us, the modern digital hearing aid can do a lot to help. Until the electronic age, deaf aids were confined to mechanical devices, the simplest of which is your hand cupped behind your ear. This improves hearing for 2 reasons. Concentration of the sound by reflection into your ear, or amplification, and reduction of unwanted ambient noise, or directivity. Both effects improve the signal-to-noise ratio, but do little else. The ancient Greeks and Egyptians, and the Romans, all knew about ear trumpets. But for the next several millennia, until Graham Alexander Bell came along with his carbon microphone, all deaf aids worked on the same principle. Large directional collection area, a small orifice plugged into lughole. Unfortunately, mechanical devices cannot be tailor-made to alleviate specific types of deafness. Nevertheless, ear trumpets could be effective, but were neither convenient nor discreet, and were the butt of many an unkind joke. Perhaps the largest ear trumpets ever made were the acoustic aircraft detection devices used in late World War I and early World War II prior to radar, the largest reputed to be a concrete acoustic mirror array built in southern England. This was some 200 feet long and could hear an aircraft engine well over 20 miles away, outperforming the smaller but more mobile anti-aircraft sound detectors. Effective, but not exactly portable. One can only hope that the enemy played ball by coming in from the approved direction. The advent of the telephone with its carbon granule microphone led to attempts to use it as a hearing aid, but amplification was limited, and I doubt if the fidelity of the system did much for deaf ears either. Things didn't really take off until the early 1920s, when amplifying valves appeared on the scene. Take-off is perhaps the wrong expression, because early valve hearing amplifiers were tabletop affairs powered by low-tension accumulators and high-tension battery banks, while the amplified audio was delivered via a pair of bulky headphones. The good old ear trumpet was still tops for portability. But, of course, technology improves with time. By the mid-1930s, miniaturized valves were becoming available, dry batteries were improving, and things were looking up. By then, you could get a nice little unit that fitted around your waist, weighed only about 0.5 kilogram, and was powered by a separate box containing LT and HT batteries, with a plug-in microphone, and used either 1 or 2 earphones. Battery life was very limited, so the on-off switch got plenty of use. And even today, sometimes the on-off switch is the deaf aid's best control, but we'll say no more on that point. World War II saw great strides in both component miniaturization and battery technology. By the 1950s, quite small valve-type hearing aids using very small wire-ended valves and printed circuit boards were available, while small plug-in earpieces were less obtrusive than headphones. Battery life, especially LT for the valve filaments, was still a problem, and apart from a basic tone control, the aid was still little more than an electronic ear trumpet. In the 1960s, transistors revolutionized the hearing aid. As inferred earlier, a major problem with deafness is loss of dynamic range. We can no longer hear soft sounds yet loud sounds may overload the ear. The mechanics of the ear mean that a deaf person may be unable to tolerate loud sounds like a younger person can, and shouting may not help at all. The loss of high frequency response means simple sound amplification is insufficient. To compensate for a reduced dynamic range, sound compression is essential so that soft sounds can be expanded and loud ones limited. Frequency compensation by greater amplification of the frequencies where deafness is more pronounced enhances clarity. Transistorization in the 1960s meant much smaller dimensions, lower power consumption, and above all, the opportunity to provide some degree of sound tailoring. The audio spectrum could be divided up into six bands, each amplified to the degree required, while compression of 20 dB or so could be achieved to assist with the loss of dynamic range. Things were starting to look up, and the introduction of integrated circuit technology meant discrete, behind-the-ear, or even in-the-ear units were becoming possible. Prior to 1991, all deaf aids in Australia used analog technology. Since then, digital hearing aids have been taking over. Digital techniques have opened up a new world to the deaf through ever greater miniaturization, sound processing tailored to the individual's need, and even the provision of unidirectional or omnidirectional sound pickup as required. Some aids can even adjust themselves to the ambient noise environment to give the user optimum sound clarity. Feedback, the cause of annoying whistling or self-oscillation in analog hearing aids, when used at high gain levels, can be much reduced in digital aids, allowing 10 dB or 100 times power of extra amplification. Unfortunately, they do come with a price tag to match their performance, but in time this could reduce. Things have moved on a long, long way since those ancient ear trumpets. Finally, just a quick footnote. The difference in pressure between the threshold of hearing and the threshold of pain varies in individuals, but 130 decibels, or 10 million million times, is typical. This remarkable dynamic range is enhanced by an effective amplification structure within the ear, which extends its low-end sensitivity, and by a protective mechanism which tends to limit high-end sensitivity. Severe deafness may reduce this dynamic range to just a few tens of dB. A skilled deaf aid audiologist, together with the latest digital amplification techniques, can do much to improve a deaf person's quality of life.
It has been a long-standing practice for these broadcasts to finish off with something humorous, so here is today's offering.
A police officer came upon a terrible car smash in which the driver and passenger had both been badly injured. As he studied the wreckage, a dog came out of the bushes and hopped around the crashed car. The officer looked down at the dog and said, "I wish you could talk." The dog looked up at the officer and shook his head up and down. "You can understand what I'm saying?" asked the officer incredulously. Again, the dog shook his head up and down. "Well, did you see this accident?" "Yes," motioned the dog. "What happened?" The dog pretended to have a can in his hand and raised it to his mouth. "They were drinking?" asked the officer. "Yes," nodded the dog. "What else?" The dog pinched his fingers together, held them to his mouth, and adopted a dreamy expression. "They were smoking marijuana?" "Yes," motioned the dog. "Now wait," continued the officer. "You're saying your owners were drinking and smoking before they had the accident?" "Yes," nodded the dog. "And what were you doing during all this?" "Driving," motioned the dog.
Thank you for listening. This concludes our session for this month. We shall be back with you on Monday, the 3rd of December, 2018. in what will be not only the last broadcast for this year, but also the last broadcast that Ian and I shall do together. Until then, keep well and smiling. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Alzheimer's Club of Australia, saying 73 and listening now for any check-ins and callbacks.